The internet has revolutionized how we gather and consume information. It's also made a huge amount of info available to anyone interested in finding it.
Well, the digital revolution has leveled the information playing field. It also means that anyone with a device and a Wi-Fi connection can publish and manipulate data.
So, how can we figure out what is truth and what's fiction in this new online world?
With us now is Charles Seif, professor of journalism at New York University and the author of Virtual Unreality. Just because the internet told you so, how do you know it's true? Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you start your book with a story about how a Sesame Street character went from being the star of one guy's whimsical pet website to kind of an actual player in Middle East imaging and politics. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, that was a very curious story. There was this website for a number of years early on the web called Bert is Evil. And it was one of these joke websites where people photoshopped Bert, the Muppet character, into various historical situations, like an evil Forrest Gump or an evil Zelig. So they photoshopped a picture of Bert sitting behind Hitler or consulting with Pol Pot or riding along with Stalin. And they also created one with Bert standing behind the shoulder of Osama bin Laden. And it was just this joke, and it circulated around the web. People laughed. But then September 11th happened, and there was a series of protests in the Middle East and Indonesia supporting Osama bin Laden. And there were a number of print shops that put out posters of Osama bin Laden with his picture on it. And on one of these posters, there behind Osama bin Laden's shoulder was Bert. And there it was in Indonesia. People were marching along, shouting down with the USA, holding up placards with the lovable Muppet Bert in support of Osama bin Laden. So what happened with this idea, this joke idea that Bert is evil, crystallized and became real. He actually became evil in some sense, hanging out with Osama bin Laden in real anti-American rallies. Of course, the Muppet Masters, the Children's Television Workshop, were furious. They thought it was immoral for people to use Bert's image to support Osama bin Laden, but I think that was the least immoral thing going on that day. But it was a good example of how this idea, kind of in a fringe, a joke that wouldn't have gotten very far before the days of the web, got all the way to Bangladesh and Indonesia and wound up being projected on the world stage. And people actually took photographs of those Bert behind Osama bin Laden posters.
And Osama bin Laden's code name during the final operation that took his life was apparently Bert.
Yes, the association stayed until the very end. The SEAL team called him Bert.
It's an example of what you call virtual unreality. How would you define that term?
Virtual unreality is this... It's a state of being where things are no longer entirely real or entirely unreal, that we are filtering our reality through a new set of tools, through digital tools that help us view the world, digital tools that help us gather information, digital tools that help us disseminate information. And those digital tools sometimes work beautifully and help us and amplify our thoughts and project them, but sometimes they distort things in strange and subtle ways. And sometimes other people use them to distort our ideas. And we're becoming unaware of the fact that we are being digitally manipulated. And so virtual unreality is a state of being where we are dependent upon a new set of tools that have worked their way into our lives, and we're unaware that these tools are manipulating and controlling the information that we view.
Yeah, and you say at one point that it used to take an entire force of a totalitarian government to create an alternate reality, and now it can be done to smaller effect by a guy in his basement or sitting alone, you know, somewhere in Scotland, as we saw as another example in the book. How do we go from being an easy audience to this kind of unreality to being a skeptical one?
It's not so easy because it's a lot of work, and because there's so much information out there, one of the great things about digital information is that there's a huge amount out there, and everyone can put it on the web and publish. You go to Twitter, you go to Facebook, everyone's publishing, and so there's a huge amount of information out there. There's so much that we actually are dependent upon robots and filters to bring to us what we want to view. And so that creates a vulnerability. For example, with Wikipedia, all of us, if you're looking up something for the first time, you go to Wikipedia. It's fairly natural. It's a pretty good resource. But there are people putting false information in Wikipedia all the time, sometimes for jokes, sometimes to manipulate public opinion. My favorite example is of a baseball player, an outfielder named Mike Trout. And someone jokingly put in his Wikipedia entry that he had a nickname, the Millville Meteor, named after Millville, New Jersey, where he grew up. It wasn't true, but it became, because it was in Wikipedia, it was cited in a baseball encyclopedia and then wound up in the Daily News. And once it was in the Daily News, Wikipedia pointed to that Daily News article as proof that, yes, in fact, this guy is named the Millville Meteor. And all of a sudden, Mike Trout was baffled to notice that people were calling him the Millville Meteor. He had no idea where it came from. But now he's actually nicknamed the Millville Meteor. He's signing baseballs, the Millville Meteor, because someone created this idea in Wikipedia. And it turned from this falsehood into reality just by the force of being put in Wikipedia.
And advocates of the sort of crowdsourcing that Wikipedia does might say that this is good, that it's sort of a democratizing way to disseminate knowledge. What do you think about that argument?
Well, democracy is good, but the thing about knowledge is it's not democratic, that there are minority opinions that are, or even fringe opinions that are correct, and the majority is wrong, that you can't take a vote in this operating chamber to determine whether or not the heart has three or four chambers. It just is. It has four chambers. And the thing about Wikipedia, it's very powerful at gathering a huge amount of eclectic knowledge, and it's a very good resource. But because everyone is collaborating and voting on these ideas, it's not necessarily the best source. It's not accurate. It has the wisdom of crowds, but it also has the stupidity of crowds as well. So a reference written by a real expert is going to be better. But what's fascinating about Wikipedia is sometimes you have these experts joining in and trying to change Wikipedia entries to make them better, and they get overruled, and their edits get changed by the crowd.
You have an appendix in your book. It's called The Top 10 Dicta of the Internet Skeptic, and number one is, Wikipedia is like an old and eccentric uncle. Is that the way we should think about what we find there?
Yeah. It's fun to sit with your uncle. He can tell you a lot of stuff, and he knows a lot. He's been around. But sometimes he's been drinking a little too much. Sometimes his viewpoints are a little off. So if there's anything that's important to you, I mean, Wikipedia is a very good first stop to find something out, but if it's really important to you to know whether it's correct or not, Wikipedia is not the end of your journey. You should use Wikipedia to start out your searches and then go to more reliable, more authoritative sources.
Another piece of ground that you cover is social media, and you also write in the same appendix that social media's site's purpose is to serve its users in the same sense as a zoo's purpose is to serve its animals. So given the number of people who are involved every day in social media, what do we need to know to be skeptical and be savvy about how we use it?
Yeah, social media, I mean, if you think about it, it's a boon to all of us that we're able to keep in touch with our friends, we're able to tap into current trends. But the way that these social media companies make their money has nothing really directly to do with making you, the user, happy. It's making their advertisers happy, or their sponsors, the people who are paying money. And sponsors are made happy when you, the user, are exposed to new products and buy new stuff. And so it shouldn't be any surprise that social media companies aren't providing you with a platform out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing it to sell you products. And they're also doing it to extract information from you. And every few months, there's some sort of uproar as one of the major social media platforms, Twitter or Facebook is particularly bad at this, changes their privacy policy to do something that people find outrageous. And there's a complaint on the Internet for a few days, and then it disappears, and people continue using Facebook as they did before. But that means that Facebook is gathering a huge amount of information on how you do business, what websites you look at, how long you spend on these websites, whom you communicate with, why do you communicate with them. Now Facebook is going to be gathering information on sounds and what you're listening to. All this information is monetizable. It is valuable and is being gathered with your implicit consent, even if you're not aware of it. And this sort of information is not something you'd be giving the government or people outside of your close social circle. If the government were demanded to listen in on everything your cell phone was saying, you would rightly feel that this is the action of a totalitarian state. But when Facebook listens into all of your conversations online and possibly even to all the sounds in your room, that's progress. Everyone seems to be happy with it.
So given all of this, Wikipedia, social media, the ever-ready audience of the Internet, what specific tips or tools can you share to help us separate reality from unreality?
Well, there's a few things. The first thing is anything that's important to you, always try to find the provenance of the information. Trace back a bit of information to where it comes from. It's not that hard to do it often. Start with Wikipedia and go through the references, see where they're getting their information from, and trace it backwards. Similarly, when someone tells you something, it's important to understand whether that is coming from a neutral point of view or a biased point of view. You have to figure out who that person is. And often online, it's not easy to figure out whether somebody's a real person or not. So in the book, I give you some tools like using image searches or using what are called IP addresses to try to trace back a person to his origin to see whether he's real or not or whether he is faking something. Generally speaking, it's just the book is attempting to make you aware of these manipulations that are going on. There's no fast and easy answer because these tools are very useful to us, that we're saving a huge amount of time by having robots do our news gathering for us. So we're not going to give it up. But we do have to be aware that this is a different way of life than it was just 10 years ago, in a very concrete and scary way in some ways. So awareness is part of the battle, that when something comes through the news wires and it's breaking across all over Google News, just having that little sense of skepticism in your mind that there's a lot of manipulation out there and taking a step back to see whether it's real rather than rushing on the bandwagon would benefit.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was Charles Seif, the author of the book Virtual Unreality.